Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy. Kia ora, Dave. How was your Christmas?
Kia ora tātou. Quite relaxed. Thank you very much. It's been a lovely sunny January. So, all set for the perils of 2024.
Yeah, I had a bit of a really positive feedback from a long-time listener yesterday who described this podcast as having a Dave in her pocket. Which was fantastic, and just a shout out to the listeners. You know, we're really welcome feedback. You can find feedback opportunities through the website, and we're really interested to hear any comments, any suggestions for improvements and things as well. But shall we kick into the January clinical snippets? Or first, for those people who haven't met you before, tell us a bit about yourself, Dave.
So I'm long history in general practice, quite a long history now, 15 years of being in-house advisor to Health and Disability Commissioner. So I get to see the kind of, I guess, the negative side of general practice, which preoccupies me.
But the room for improvement in general practice.
Yeah, perhaps. Well, what I try and do, I guess, through this podcast in some ways is help maintain an awareness of keeping yourself safe, keeping yourself away from complaints, hopefully, and just keeping up with the tons and tons of medical information we're bombarded with
on a weekly basis. I'm Joe Scott Jones. I'm educated by you. I'm a GP and just love these interactions. So let's kick on with it, Dave. And I'm intrigued to find out what I need to start learning for 2024.
Yeah, well, the first one is one of my favorite topics, which is dermatological conditions with bizarre names. and this one actually came out of the December edition of Prescriber Update, which had an article on symmetrical drug-related intertriginous and flexural exanthema, or S-drife. So it's a type 4 delayed hypersensitivity reaction. And it presents with a well-defined symmetrical V-shaped erythematous rash, usually the gluteal region or groin. And it's got an original name of baboon syndrome. After the baboons with the red backsides. So there's often involvement of at least one other skin site, a skin fold or flexural area, such as the axilla or behind the knees. There are usually very few systemic symptoms. And aside from the rash, the patient's usually well. But the most common medicines associated with S-drife are beta-lactam antibiotics, so penicillins, amoxicillin, cephalosporins, and they are implicated in about 50% of S-drife cases. But there are numerous other medications that it's been associated with. Re-exposure to the suspect medicine usually causes the rash to recur, but it's generally self-limiting and should resolve when the suspect medicine's withdrawn, although topical steroids might help to resolve the rash a bit more quickly. And there are images, or there's discussion of the condition and images on DermNet, and I've just put the images up, and you can see why it gets the name baboon rash with the sort of buttock, basically red buttocks.
Yeah.
That's part of the syndrome. But yeah, the number of drugs, it's a long list.
Wow.
But certainly the beta-lactams would be the majority of cases.
Yeah. Reminds me of my childhood, the red buttocks and being brought up in a Catholic school. But that's another story I should seek counselling for over a long time.
It's more of a friction rash, I'd say, isn't it? Friction with the leather strap.
That's lovely. So I suppose that now, like a fixed drug eruption, we might have called it at some stage.
And the fact that it recurs, and I think it's really just this characteristic distribution has given it this rather complex name.
But definitely something to think about if you've got somebody who you think might have got an unusual nappy rash or something like that.
After starting a new medication.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So on the medication and adverse effects theme, just a reminder again, because MedSafe has updated its alert information on the use of sodium valproate in people who can father children.
Yes.
And they've reanalyzed the main retrospective observational study that looked at potential adverse effects. So the recommendations for health professionals are use of sodium valproate within the 3 months prior to conception by people who are able to father children has been linked to potential increased risk of neurodevelopmental disorders in children compared to those who took lamotrigine or levetiracetam. So that's quite significant. So
Yes.
the father using it within 3 months of conception. The potential risks to children fathered more than 3 months after stopping valproate are unknown, but that's the time taken for new sperm to be formed. So you might extrapolate that it's lesser risk if they've been offered for more than 3 months prior to conception. Inform patients of this potential risk and consider alternative treatment options for those wishing to father a child. That's probably important in terms of informed consent when re-prescribing the information, if it's new prescribing information. Discuss the need for effective contraception when starting sodium valproate and periodically throughout treatment. And if discontinuing treatment, continue effective contraception for 3 months. And also inform the patients to avoid donating sperm while taking sodium valproate and for 3 months after stopping treatment. So the company's produced a guide, which I think is available on New Zealand Formulary through New Zealand Formulary, but you can provide that to all patients of reproductive potential using sodium valproate.
I had a conversation with a patient about exactly this just before Christmas, and they were sort of aware, but it was really exactly that. It was printed out the information from New Zealand Formulary, but they'd sort of heard through various means. But it's a bit about it's about reiterating it multiple times, because I think I know that I need to get information in lots of different ways repeatedly for it to really stick. And this is really important.
And I think the issue too is that while this might be fresh in our minds when we're initiating treatment, it's the repeat, the quick repeat prescription, please, of somebody, who might have started it when they were 9 or 10 and they're now 16 or 17 or 20 even, and the need to actually inform of this relatively new information.
Especially for our colleagues who might be working remotely and with supporting practices in patients that they've never even met.
Interesting. I'm not sure how the best way of recording the fact that the information has been provided would be, because you don't have to be doing it every time you do a repeat script.
I'm making a note to say, given the information from Healthify or from New Zealand Formulary, I'm being I'm now being very explicit about that.
Well, if it's lost in the body of the notes, it's could be hard to track, couldn't it? Whether
Well,
or do you do it as an alert?
no, I do it to say that I've done it when I'm doing it in the body of the notes, and it's really just a question of recording what it is that I'm the information that I'm giving to people, and I'm so that I should the shit hit the fan at some stage, then
You're covered.
I'm told people, yes, and I did give you this information.
Moving on to something totally different, but again, topical because of recent stuff in the lay press. So in November, Bunnings and IKEA announced they would stop selling engineered stone because of the adverse effects on tradespeople working with the product, which is basically the accelerated silicosis. So on the previous episode of the podcast, we've talked about the accelerated silicosis assessment pathway. And BPAC have recently published a comprehensive article on accelerated silicosis, including details of the assessment pathway, well worth looking at. Health Pathways also gives a really good guide to the assessment pathway, and that would probably be my go-to resource, the Health Pathways, if you're dealing with a accelerated silicosis assessment request for the first time, because it lays it out quite briefly but informatively what you need to do. So at this stage, all tradespeople who have worked with engineered stone for more than 6 months in the past 10 years are being encouraged to see their GP. And as at September 2023, 190 claims had been lodged with the accelerated silicosis assessment pathway. So I assume there are a lot more out there to come, because 190 doesn't seem a big workforce. But basically, the pathway involves an initial GP assessment, which can be undertaken via telehealth, And that's to basically really to establish exposure history, risk factors, and presence of symptoms. So past and current silica exposure, measures taken to reduce exposure at the time, any symptoms, smoking history, and any workplace monitoring such as spirometry, and then respiratory examination if practical and consent for information to be provided to ACC. And if the patient's then deemed to be at possible risk of AS, so you've established they have worked with Stone for more than 6 months in the last 10 years, then an ACC claim is completed. ACC then assess the claim and they direct the further investigation if required, which will be quite explicit directions to you about what is required. And that usually includes a funded 30-minute comprehensive GP assessment, including completion of the adapted crystalline silica health form medical section, which is available online, and I've got a link to that in the podcast, but also arranging spirometry and further investigations as deemed necessary. And psychosocial support may also be required for patients with confirmed accelerated silicosis because of the not great prognosis associated with it.
You'd have imagined there's got to be more than 190 people out there in this situation, and presumably it doesn't have to be continuous work with
Stone.
It's if you've 3 months here and 3 months there, you've got more than 6 months worth of exposure over that period of time.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long there's been this fad for the engineered stone, but it must be. I'm sure it's accelerated in the last 5 years or so before this raised itself as an issue.
And I think when we last had our kitchen done, because we've got it all in the kitchens. So over 10 years ago, I'm sure.
And maybe if you're building a house, consider using granite or formica rather than engineered stone.
Marble, Dave. Marble.
Marble. Yeah. if you're an ophthalmic surgeon, you can use marble. Another topical one. This is really just coming out of the December Waikato Public Health Bulletin, which talks about the risks of cyanotoxin poisoning secondary to cyanobacteria. So this is the time of the year where the lakes can be affected by blooms of the cyanobacteria. And there's actually a really helpful BPAC article from 2020, which looks at the identification and management of cyanotoxin poisoning. So there's a link to that. There's no specific test available to confirm it, and the diagnosis is based on the clinical symptoms and signs in association with a history of exposure, such as swimming or boating on a river or lake with current cyanobacterial bloom, and excluding other causes. But there might be non-specific tests indicated based on the patient's symptoms. So if they're yellow, then probably do some liver function.
Yeah.
But the symptoms are related to the type of exposure. So with just direct skin contact, you might see urticaria, dermatitis, perioral and perinasal blisters, or other types of rashes. If they've possibly inhaled the water spray, you tend to get bronchospasm, rhinitis, sore throat, pneumonia, and occasionally severe allergic reactions. And with swallowing the water, gastroenteritis, malaise, elevated liver enzymes, and neurological symptoms, including dizziness, vertigo, hearing loss, and visual disturbances, occasionally seizures. And that includes water ingestion, but also shellfish or algae-based supplements that are contaminated with the cyanotoxin.
Yeah.
So the time to onset and duration of symptoms is actually really variable. So typically it's within 24 hours of exposure and can last several days, but sometimes it's a little later than that. No antidotes, so treatment's symptomatic or supportive and based on the type and severity of symptoms. Importantly, there's no point in boiling the contaminated water or cooking the fish or shellfish because that doesn't inactivate the cyanotoxins and sometimes results in higher concentrations of the toxins. And the toxins also aren't removed by normal water filtration systems. So the fact that they had the billy on the fire, or the potentially contaminated water supply comes through a filter, doesn't reduce the risk of the cyanotoxin poisoning. And it is a notifiable or recommended that you notify the medical officer of health if you suspect cyanotoxin poisoning using the Hazardous Substance Disease and Injury Reporting Tool, which I understand is incorporated into some PMSs. I'm not sure about indice, but you can also notify them via e-referral.
Yeah. The Hazardous Substances Disease and Inquiry Reporting Tool, HisDirt.
HisDirt.
Is it very nice? So I've certainly come across this in shellfish poisoning from people collecting caimoana along the East Cape, you know, sort of around a Port of Key. And when I was working in Gisborne, there was issues with so I don't know whether that's the cyanobacteria. It's very similar sort of disease presentation, but with sometimes with quite pronounced neurological impacts, you know,
Yeah,
the
there's a
nerves being
ciguatera
ridden
as well, isn't there, which is more of a tropical thing. I think ciguatera
from
from
reef fish.
fish, and yeah, which gives neurological symptoms, I think, as well.
But and we'll see that in returning travelers who maybe have had their final, you know, big meal before they've left the islands and returned to us. So definitely, and they're the sort of things that you just need to have in your diagnostic tree as not the most likely, but things you mustn't miss. Awesome. Thanks for that.
So helpful things, respiratory resources. So Asthma and Respiratory Foundation have launched a new COPD handbook to help those living with COPD of varying severity. Links to both these resources are in the podcast, in the written part of the podcast. It's a great, I've looked through it. It's very comprehensive, provides general information about COPD from the various symptoms that the patient may get to the different types of treatment and medication. And it includes some really helpful tips and advice about self-management and general lifestyle management. So just another resource to be able to hand out if you're diagnosing someone with COPD or patients with existing COPD that might benefit from some additional support. They've also released a reference guide to supporting rangatahi to quit vaping, and it aims to help health professionals who work with adolescents and young adults to tackle vaping and e-cigarette addiction. And they work through five important steps, which are screening, assessment, behavioral support, pharmacotherapy, and follow-up. So there's, again, really helpful practical advice on working through those areas. So again, if you've got your smoking cessation nurses that are working, that might be quite a helpful resource if you're going to be referring rangatahi with vaping issues to them as well.
Wonder what the tax take is from vaping.
No idea.
No idea.
No idea. I don't know
Maybe
what.
we should just leave that hanging, Dave. We should just leave that hanging
Well,
because
I.
it'd be really great. What really makes a big impact with these sorts of things is systematic barriers and changes that make it more difficult to access the drugs of addiction, isn't it? And we're trying to shut the door after the horse has bolted with vaping. We need to shut the door.
I mean, I think it's we may be getting close to the smoke-free 2025, but shifting a large number from smoking to vaping probably wasn't in the original aim of smoke-free 2025, I don't think, was it?
No. Okay, we shouldn't spend too much more time talking about that because
It
we'll get
could get
ourselves into
political.
some political trouble.
Yes. Although, really, why aren't cigarettes available only from vape shops? Which have the bollards outside them and have the metal screens they pull down and are required to check the IDs of people coming in asking for products. But anyway, number six I found fascinating. So this arose out of a December a college ePulse edition with a note from Luke Bradford referring to a coroner's recent finding into the use of sodium nitrite being used in six suicides in New Zealand. So the use of sodium nitrite has been promoted on several suicide and euthanasia websites, with people being advised to see their GP first to get a prescription for metoclopramide to take alongside the sodium nitrite to prevent nausea and vomiting. And four of the six cases being looked at by the coroner did just this. So a Canadian man has recently been charged with 14 counts of second-degree murder in relation to deaths in Ontario province associated with sodium nitrite suicide kits he was selling online. And 90 similar deaths in the UK are being investigated related to him supplying these kits. And he'd apparently distributed over 1,200 kits to people in 40 countries, including New Zealand. But you can actually buy sodium nitrite. It appears readily in New Zealand because it's used for animal control and in rust inhibition car products. So I just looked online and put in sodium nitrite, and there were several, sort of direct to consumer sites. So I'm not sure how much vetting they do when you when you order it, or whether you've got to order, you know, a sack full
Presumably, it's
to
pretty
qualify.
unpalatable to drink rust remover.
Well, that's it must be, I think, if you need the metoclopramide. But basically, the message was for GPs, these findings come out as a timely reminder to have awareness around patients who specifically request a prescription for metoclopramide, especially patients with a history of mental health disorders or patients who are known to be going through trauma or having suicidal ideation. These requests should trigger further exploration by the GP. So the chemical causes methemoglobinemia and is actually available on New Zealand formulary in injectable form to treat cyanide poisoning.
Right.
So it is an antidote, but you know, without the cyanide, it will kill you essentially, and you'll be, I think, I can't remember what color you go, bright blue or something like that, in your death throes.
With cyanide poisoning, yeah, you do. And I'm because people are using cyanide in pest control, I've definitely been asked in the past to provide an antidote for people to have in a medicine cabinet, particularly for those remote rural patients who might be more likely to be using this. So, it'd be years and years ago since I was asked about that. And I don't recall providing anything.
Yeah. I imagine it would be present in most EDs, you'd think, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And but you know, there's it's available.
Yeah.
But the key thing is, if somebody's coming in and saying, "I would like 10 metoclopramide tablets, please, because I may be feeling nauseous at some stage in the future," that's a little red flag.
Be aware.
Particularly if they've got that vulnerability in the background.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So just a couple of interesting ones to round off. Number seven was just discussing a recent Court of Appeal ruling. So ACC, this resulted in ACC failing in an attempt to reject an earlier High Court ruling that a 20-year-old patient known as AZ with spina bifida should be eligible for ACC cover, as the congenital defect was not detected at the mother's 20-week scan, and had it been detected, the mother states she would have terminated the pregnancy. So the judge's reasoning was that the misdiagnosis and failure to terminate was a treatment injury that caused AZ's personal injury, that personal injury being spina bifida. Quoting, the only option to prevent the birth of a child with spina bifida was termination of the pregnancy. Therefore, termination of the pregnancy would have been treatment of AZ, which operated to prevent the continuation of spina bifida, even though the outcome of the termination would have been to prevent AZ's birth. If you can work out that reasoning. But the lawyer for ACC had argued that the High Court was incorrect in applying the ACC Act, because the treatment, which was a 20-week scan, did not cause the injury, and that the proposed treatment, a termination of AZ in utero, was not a medical treatment of the condition. It just ends life.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to explore in detail the judge's rationale for working this for their decision.
So sorry, Dave, I missed. So the implications of this are that our patients who have spina bifida can or cannot now look to claim something from ACC.
Yeah. So I think if the it would depend on lots of things, including, I guess, the quality of scanning and the whole scanning process at the time of diagnosis, but at the time they were born.
Yeah.
But I would imagine if they looked back and found that their mother had an anatomy, a fetal anatomy scan and a 20-week scan, say, and spina bifida was not reported, and they were born with spina bifida, there would be the opportunity for them to retrospectively put in a claim.
So that's going to have implications for all of that congenital abnormality antenatal scanning, which is recommended in the guidelines, that many of us are unaware of, and certainly we're not when most clinics advise people to seek a midwife after diagnosing the pregnancy. We provide them the kit. We say seek the midwife, and the midwife will take things from here.
Yeah.
But there's 9 weeks and 14 weeks, is it? That where there are potentials for doing antenatal screening for congenital abnormalities.
Yeah.
And if we don't encourage that to happen, then potentially there's a treatment injury claim lying ahead.
That would be stretching it, I would imagine, but you never know. But I think the other precedent is deciding that a congenital defect is an injury in some way, which
Well,
this does kind of roundabout.
yeah. So that what they're saying is the injury is the lack of is the misdiagnosis. It's not the injury isn't the spina bifida. The injury is the misdiagnosis and the inability to it to then be treated.
Well, they're saying so the misdiagnosis so and failure to terminate was a treatment injury that caused AZ's personal injury, spina bifida, is what the court determined. So anyway, interesting precedent, but it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that in terms of congenital
Absolutely.
injuries.
So certainly the not having the scan didn't cause the spina bifida, or the scan not being detecting the spina bifida didn't cause the spina bifida.
It's
The spina bifida
that was
has got
the
a completely different
defense.
cause.
Yeah, that was the ACC's argument, absolutely. And that in fact the termination wasn't a treatment for spina bifida. It was just to terminate, it was just to end the fetus's life. So
I think that on principle, I would like to see people who have congenital issues like this getting the maximum amount of help from the government, whether that's coming through ACC or wherever it's coming from. Whatever the process that and it needs to be fair and just, but they
I
need
think
the support
absolutely. I
from.
think, I mean, this was interesting from a legal point of view, but from an ethical point of view of the huge difference in terms of services you get, whether your paraplegia was from an accident versus congenital defect is unethical, basically.
Absolutely.
And just to round things up, this one's entitled An Eye to the Future, titled An Eye to the Future, which is a recent phase two study called the KARDIA-1 study, which was around a single injection of the investigational antihypertensive agent zilebesiran, and noting that it effectively lowered blood pressure in adults with mild to moderate hypertension for up to 6 months. So this is a single injection with what appeared to be an encouraging side effect profile. So there was a mean reduction in systolic blood pressure from baseline to month 6 of around 10 millimeters of mercury, and the drug zilebesiran is a subcutaneous injectable that targets hepatic angiotensinogen synthesis by RNA interference. So you might get, as soon as RNA is mentioned, you might get half the population not wanting to ever go near it. But there were four non-serious adverse reactions leading to discontinuation in the active group. So two instances of orthostatic hypotension, one of blood pressure elevation, and one of injection site reaction, but otherwise very well tolerated. So it may be in the not too distant future that you pop in once every 6 months, or you administer your own subcut injection once every 6 months to get your blood pressure control.
I think I would opt for that. Although once you get your orthostatic hypotension, presumably it lasts for 6 months.
Yeah, you might have to then go on to some what's that steroidy stuff that you take to push your blood pressure up.
Yes. Oh no. Oh, Dave.
I know, I've got the same mental block. So anyway, our listeners will know for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Oh no, that's going to torture me. That's going to torture me. All right, maybe it'll come to us while we're. So thanks, Dave. I talked about that interesting drug reaction, C-drif, S-drif, which is a sort of like a flexural exanthema, which associated with a whole range of different medications. And again, I think what struck me there is something I would think about with unexplained, unusual nappy rash, particularly if there's been any sort of change in medication. That reminder about sodium valproate and men. And of course, we know the issues for women of childbearing potential. But for 3 months before, you need to have stopped the sodium valproate. And the silicosis, a reminder about, I suppose, I think we have to be alert for that with our patients because it might be one of those things that our patients are putting in the too hard basket. And they're going to quite often, these are going to be relatively young men who are, not likely to worry about this sort of thing, So, we might need to be prompting people to think about it. Cyanobacteria, which I know we do sort of talk about from the Waikato, but is sort of prevalent across the whole of the country, particularly this warmer time of year. And something to be, again, there will be the first case which will come to light. And then, you know, if it's just there in your diagnostic tree as a perhaps not the most likely thing, but, you know, something you shouldn't miss. Vaping and then that those interesting things about metoclopramide and people having assisted suicides from this Canadian guy who hopefully has been stopped from
well, he's in prison at the moment, I think, awaiting trials, or in custody, awaiting trials.
In custody. Hopefully he hasn't got access to the internet. And then that real challenge around ACC. So has that ACC thing been finalised now? Is that a, or is it going to appeal?
I think that was the end of the line. That was the Court of Appeal ruling. That's as far as you can go, I think.
Right.
So that's it. Yeah.
There will be the look for some potential consequences from that. And then, do you raise blood pressure medications because you know that I'm on blood pressure medications?
not deliberately.
No. It's not you actually provided me with that counselling that I obviously need. Tell me about weight loss next time, Dave.
I did raise the question about the steroid used to raise blood pressure to check your cognitive function.
Yes.
Okay. And, I'm afraid we both failed miserably on that one.
We both failed miserably. Okay. Thanks, Dave. I'm going to have to add that as an extra after the end of this, after we go away, because we're going to have to look it up. But no, it's not. Oh. Okay, kagite, Dave. See you again next month.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.
So desmopressin. Isn't that desmopressin?
Fludrocortisone.
Fludrocortisone.
Fludrocortisone. Yeah.
As soon as the stress goes away, it's all, yeah.
We're still okay to practice.
Okay. Oh well. Well, you're the one to know, Dave. Oh God, I don't know how to stop recording now.